I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Today we're looking at the emergence of the mandate system at the end of the First World War as a result of the Paris Peace Conference and then the Treaty of Versailles. We're looking at a transitional moment here from the kind of the scramble for colonies that the British and the French particularly engaged in the first kind of moves of the Paris Peace Conference, where really the British particularly were looking to acquire places like Mesopotamia because of oil, and Mesopotamia obviously becoming modern day Iraq, we're going to look at how external factors such as the threat of the new Bolshevik regime in Russia and the pressure placed on the British and the French by the Americans, and the American public particularly, that had very little interest in becoming involved in imperial acquisitions and sacrificing American lives for British and French empires. We're looking at an amazing book by Susan Peterson called The Guardians, The League of Nations and the Crisis of Empire. In the section, The Emergence of the Mandates Plan, page 23, if you've got a copy, she writes, "To explain how that wartime scramble gave way within a year to a plan to entrust civilized, in inverted commas, peoples with benevolent tutelage, also in inverted commas, of the rest, we have to look beyond imperial statesmen and their machinations. There is a reason for this. Faced with the Bolshevik challenge and an American public unwilling to fight a war for imperial aims, a vain and bookish president promised a peace of a new kind, a peace without annexations or indemnities, overseen by a new global body, the League of Nations. That Wilsonian moment, as we know, elicited a response that Wilson never imagined, with mobilized publics from Korea to Poland to Samoa, not to mention the populations already taking matters into their own hands in the Middle East, deciding that the president's stirring words applied to them." A great example of this would be the May the 4th protests in China. In China, there were, at the end of the First World War, China had not fought in the First World War, and labour battalions had been, of Chinese workers, had been present on the Western Front and in Russia, but China had not fought in the First World War. But there were huge, huge celebrations in November 1918 at the news that the First World War was over. Why? Because many people believed it was a war to end empires, and China had been subjugated by European and then Japanese imperialism for almost 100 years at that point. And there was a great enthusiasm for a post-war order in which empires would be dismantled. And by May of 1919, it became clear that the new imperial power in China would be Japan, much to the anger of Chinese students, intelligentsia, and others. So it shows you that there was this great surge in the hopes of colonized people around the world. And Wilson had never really intended this. Wilson had never really intended some great kind of meltdown of all imperial relations at all. Susan Peterson writes, "To fight the tiger or to ride it? It's enormously consequential that the British government decided, not for the last time, that they had no alternative but to be on the American side. Indeed, not only were British officials and intellectuals already fully engaged in transatlantic dialogue about the creation of a League of Nations, but when it came to the particular question of how to reform imperial practice, the British were out ahead. This was the case partly because British politicians were constrained by the same liberal political culture that both hampered and empowered Wilson. And like France and Belgium, Britain too had entered the First World War without being directly attacked, justifying the engagement as a defence of the rights of small states and the principles of international law. Parliamentary oversight and pressures for greater democratic control of foreign policy were strong, and openly annexationist sentiments widely deplored. True, the African conquests were widely welcomed by liberals, but only as a means of saving natives from the depredations of the Hun." The British viewed their colonialism as inherently benign. They imagined that other imperialisms inherently malign, and that the best thing you could do for poor and fortunate people in Africa was to colonise them quickly before far worse Europeans got their hands on them. Of course, there's an awful lot problematic with that entire basket of thought, but we'll come to that later. As early as 1916, the Anti-Slavery Society, the most vocal and well-placed of humanitarian lobbies, thus raised the question of how the child races of the world were to be protected at the war's end. And if the society found it absurd to imagine that Mandingos, Hereros, Polynesians, Fiats, Fans, Kikuyus might sit beside Russian, French, and German diplomats to decide their fate, 1 year later, it had changed its mind. In 1917 and early 1918, the society, the Labour Party, and an influential slice of liberal opinion all came to agree that Africans should be consulted directly about their wishes, and a system of international control established to safeguard their rights. So we can see transitions from direct kind of 19th century style colonialism to the mandate system as a sort of interaction and exchange between colonialism and liberalism. Most thought these principles entirely compatible with British imperial rule. Ideas of imperial tutelage or trusteeship had a long genealogy, with the history of British anti-slavery cited as evidence of the empire's role in generalising humanitarian norms. One of the things that has always kept the British Empire going, and has kept the British Empire still in the popular imagination of many British people as as an asset to the world, is this idea of a benign empire, this idea of an empire that is a kind of a tutor to less advanced peoples, an empire that stamped out slavery. Again, these are hugely contested concepts which we haven't quite got the scope for today, but we shall return to. Most thought these principles entirely compatible with British imperial rule. Ideas of imperial tutelage or trusteeship had long genealogy, with the history of the British anti-slavery cited as evidence of the empire's role in generalising humanitarian norms. Securing its assumptions of moral leadership, British politicians were comfortable stating that, as Lloyd George promised in June 1917, the wishes and desires and the interests of the people of the former German colonies must be the dominant factor in settling their future government. 6 months later, on the 5th of January 1918, in a speech given 3 days before Wilson's 14 points address, the Prime Minister confirmed not only that peoples of the Middle East deserve to have their separate national conditions recognised, but also that native chiefs and councils of the former German colonies were competent to consult and speak for their tribes and members. Such consultation was, after all, expected to show only a strong preference for British rule. The main problem the British would face, one Foreign Office official remarked smugly, was that we cannot hope to take into the British sphere all the peoples in the world who would doubtless like to enter it. So that shows very revealing attitudes that the British had. In his book, The Morbid Age by Richard Overy, Richard Overy writes that the view that British people had in 1939 was that the Second World War was a war for the defence of civilization itself. Civilization, could be summed up as being the British Empire, and barbarism was Nazism, the enemy at the gate, at the Empire's gates. Campaign medal that all soldiers were given at the end of the First World War had the inscription "The Great War for Civilization" written on the back of it. The Great War for the Preservation of the British Empire is the War for Civilization. So the idea was that people in former German colonies German Southwest Africa and places like that, who would become British subjects or British mandates, were joining this bigger club of civilization. Susan Peterson writes, "This leads us to another reason why Britain found Wilsonian ideas easy to accommodate, because they dovetailed so nicely with British imperial practice. British statesmen had always hunted diligently for native rulers with whom they could ally in trade. A preference for indirect rule marked the imperium at many turns. Various princes and potentates should indeed run their own affairs, guided by British residents or consuls, and with the Royal Navy keeping it with global peace. This was much the best and cheapest approach. But what imperial statesmen tended to mean by that was, as Colonial Secretary Lord Milner, here speaking of Arabia, patently explained to Lloyd George in 1919, that the native state should be kept out of the sphere of European political intrigue and within the British sphere of influence. In other words, that her independent native rulers should have no foreign treaties except with us. Indeed, the Arab Bureau had been set up to extend British hegemony along such lines. But in the process, something unexpected happened. Some of those British officials began taking Wilsonian language to heart. Consider William Ormsby Gore, a young Conservative Army officer from an aristocratic family, seconded to the Arab Bureau in 1916. Ormsby Gore had found Egyptian politics discouraging. "We rule here by fear and not by love or gratitude or loyalty." But his work building the alliance with Hussein, this is Sharif Hussein of Mecca, convinced him of a new approach, that a new approach was possible. The Sykes-Picot Agreement profoundly shocked him. This was the division of Arabia into French and British spheres of influence. Originally French, British and Russian, but after 1917, just French and British.
Cool fact, A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
We make professions of defending and helping small and oppressed nations, he protested to one of his superiors. If then we parcel out between our allies and ourselves vast tracts of countries which do not want us, we shall have to admit to the Ramsay MacDonalds, the then leader of the Labour Party, Trevelyans and Shaws at home, the obviously referring to George Bernard Shaw of the Fabian Society, and our doubting Indian critics in India, that knew better than we knew ourselves. Britain should win friends by embracing self-determination, and should do so, he thought, warm-heartedly, if not entirely logically, for both Arabs and Jews. Recalled to London in 1917, Ormsby Gore became part of the circle that crafted the Balfour Declaration, and in the spring of 1918 was sent to Palestine with Chaim Weizmann and the Zionist Commission to try to get Arab and Jewish leaders to come to some agreement regarding their respective rights and powers in future. I think what is important to recognise is that this sort of kind of colonial chauvinism wasn't viewed by those who engaged in it at the time as necessarily anything remotely sinister or bad. British colonial officials assumed that not only was it entirely correct that Britain should administer these sort of lesser places with, you know, inferior peoples, but that should be an ambition that should be shared by the people that Britain was colonising through the mandate system. And so the Wilsonian idea of mandates and the British idea that the British were a kind of a tutor neatly kind of coincide with one another. And of course, this is to ignore how France saw things as well. But we shall come to that in due course. However, Britain never acted out of a spirit of kind of benign selflessness, as Susan Peterson writes here. The British embrace of self-determination was often more cynical than that. The Sykes-Picot Agreement had been struck when the Ottomans were still in control, but by the end of 1918, virtually the whole of the Middle East was in British hands. Success bred greater ambitions as a host of policymakers began to think that the French might be pushed aside and the British Empire hold sway over a corridor of colonies and native states running from India to the Cape. When Allenby held back his troops that December and let Faisal enter Damascus on a white horse before him, as when the British officials read out the Anglo-French Declaration promising to establish national governments and administrations, deriving their authority from the initiative and free choice of the indigenous populations, they were making a bid for their own hegemony as well. As Lord Curzon and Lord President of the Council pithily put it in one cabinet committee meeting, the British were going to play self-determination for what it was worth, to secure their imperial gains. For anybody that wants to read more about the end of the First World War in the Middle East and the development of the Mandate system there, read A Line in the Sand by James Barr, and who has some really, really insightful observations to make about the motivations of the British allowing the French to have the power that they had in Syria, in essence, that the British were hoping that the French would make themselves so unpopular in Syria that the Arabs would want the British to install themselves there. But that's a slightly different conversation. After this potent brew of liberal interventionism, liberal internationalism, imperial humanitarianism, and sheer territorial acquisitiveness, the British proposals for the mandate system emerged. There was still no consensus. South African Prime Minister Jan Christian Smuts made one influential case for the British Empire as a model for the League in his December 1918 pamphlet, The League of Nations, A Practical Suggestion. But Smuts' florid production was in fact an effort at containment, for he restricted international control to the Middle East alone. Since then, the German colonies were all inhabited by barbarians, this is his language, who not only cannot possibly govern themselves, but to whom it would be impracticable to apply any ideal of political self-determination. So as far as Smuts was concerned, self-determination was something that perhaps Arabs could have, but definitely, definitely not Africans. The anti-slavery society thought otherwise, and even some within the colonial office were prepared to accept that the League should have the right to visit territories, terminate mandates, and adjudicate disputes between states. Indeed, if the League thought such stipulations should extend to all colonies, one official noted that Britain, at any rate, should have no objections to raise. France had a very different view of how mandates should be distributed, and they viewed the mandate system as the product of a very cosy Anglo-American intervention, a very cosy Anglo-American compact agreement. Throughout December, writes Susan Peterson, of 1918, French officials watched the emerging Anglo-American alliance with mounting rage. To their mind, France had won its right to territorial compensation at Verdun, and Britain's attempt to change the rules of the game amounted to treason. France needed West Africa to provide soldiers in any future war, and the Quai d'Orsay, which is the French foreign ministry, at the Quai d'Orsay, Robert de Caen thought Faisal's new Syrian state little more than a British surrogate. But when French diplomats tried to get their British counterparts to come to a bilateral agreement before the Americans arrived, they found their erstwhile allies evasive and difficult. The British, having cast in their lot with Wilson, would use that alliance to force acceptance of the mandate system nobody else wanted. So France, having been victorious over Germany, now viewed a kind of an Anglophone threat, and this has been kind of a common feature in 20th century French diplomacy, this kind of deep suspicion of the Anglophone world and its priorities. The idea that Wilson and the British had this kind of easy relationship, obviously, as we shall see, it turns out to not be the case. Wilson's kind of rhetoric around anti-imperialism did not sit well with the British, and the British, when it suited them, allied themselves with the French to undermine Wilson's more anti-colonial instincts. Wilson, of course, as the liberal figure he was, still had little time or effort or energy to help Black Americans in the South, and had probably little real interest in helping African colonized African people. The language he used, the anti-imperial language he used, was really a deep-seated resentment that kind of American presidents and diplomats had about the way in which the British and the French empires and other empires had carved up the world and cut America out of chunks of world trade. And it was that Wilson was really seeking to unravel. Wilson thought that an end to that Versailles could and should have been the means by which all European empires were ended, partly out of some idealism, but mainly because a new American empire of trade would have emerged, and did emerge throughout the 20th century, gradually swatting old colonial empires out of the way. And this was what Wilson was seeking to achieve. Actually, my Freudian slip there actually does reveal a deeper truth, because Roosevelt, like him later on during the Second World War, was motivated in largely the same way. And at the Atlantic Conference, in Placentia Bay, when Churchill met Roosevelt on the Prince of Wales battleship, the accords that the British and the Americans signed came to when it came to the moment of erasing imperial preference. That's where Churchill dug his heels in, and he saw that Roosevelt would quite happily have unravelled the British Empire then and there. Anyway, let's finish there. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. As you can see, we are putting out plenty of episodes at the moment, and there'll be some great interviews coming for you later in the week. Thanks very much. Take care, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.